Hey, good morning. It is the John Gibson Saturday morning author interview, dated Sunday morning, but actually posted Monday morning because I got late. Look, here's the book. It is Michael Medved. It is called God's Hand on America, Divine Providence in the Modern Era. Now, you know Michael. He's a famous and accomplished talk show host, as well as a New York Times best-selling author. And this is a fascinating book. And I spoke to Michael about the book, and as usual, and as you might expect, a fantastic interview from Michael Medved. Michael Medved joins me now. His new book is called God's Hand on America, Divine Providence in the Modern Era. Hey, Michael, how are you?
I'm very well, John. Great to speak to you again.
It's good to speak to you. So, you know, I really was fascinated with this book. There's a bunch of great stories in here that, as you put it, either suggest God's hand is helping America out, or we have incredibly good luck. I suspect you think that there may be some providence involved.
Well, that's what basically all of America's leaders have always seemed to believe, and including the leaders who were religiously skeptical or unconventional in their religious ideas, like Thomas Jefferson, like Benjamin Franklin to some extent, and going right through Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy and to the current day. The basic argument that I try to make, John, is that in God's hand with America, is that if you have a pattern of happy accidents, one after another, where you just keep catching breaks, it suggests intelligence design, not random evolution. It's an indication that it's not so accidental. And America's rise from being a largely unsettled continent, and we were, it's the last place in the world that someone in 1620 would have thought that the dominant civilization on planet Earth would grow up.
There is, just to give people an example of what you're talking about, let me take something that's, you know, fairly contemporary in terms of the sweep of American history, and that is the Battle of Midway. Now, I grew up with World War II parents. I knew about the Battle of Midway. I'm not sure I knew the detail or the luck or the providence involved. Why don't you explain it?
Well, neither did I, and neither do most people. But at the time, it was regularly acknowledged because, first of all, Midway occurred just 6 months after Pearl Harbor. The Japanese had been successful in not only with the Pearl Harbor attack, but had been successful in all the encounters they had with the British, with the other Western powers, with building up their empire. And they had prepared the largest armada ever prepared by any navy in the history of humanity. To basically attack Midway Island, which is called Midway Island because the Midway Atoll is halfway in between Japan and the American mainland. And then they were going to go on from Midway to Hawaii and to attack California, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles. That plan was interrupted by, first of all, a miraculous breaking of the Japanese code. And then secondly, by being able to refloat a badly damaged aircraft carrier, the Yorktown, and to do it in 24 hours, which was held to be impossible. And then most strikingly, there were three different aircraft carriers for the U.S. at Midway against four vastly superior Japanese carriers and three times the number of planes. We had the Hornet, the Enterprise, and the Yorktown. The squadrons of dauntless dive bombers took off from all three, and they were all looking for the Japanese fleet. They didn't know exactly where to find it, and they're out over open ocean. They lose contact with each other, and then they suddenly, by chance, as it were, find each other, and then at that same moment, precise moment, see the Japanese fleet. And in 5 minutes, They had destroyed basically three of the four Japanese carriers. They got the other one later in the battle. And nothing like it has ever happened in naval history. And people who participated in the Battle of Midway cited it as a miracle. In fact, Gordon Prang, who was one of the official naval historians, his book is called Miracle at Midway. There's another book by one of the participants in the battle called God Was at Midway. And in fact, it even affected the Japanese commanders because if you, one of the leading Japanese commanders who had actually led the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor was Captain Matsuo Fushida. And Captain Fushida was at Midway, was so struck by the unlikely outcome, which seemed so enormously providential. And then after the war, he actually became a Christian. He never got American citizenship, but he lived most of the time in America and extolled the virtues of America. He actually appeared with Billy Graham 8 times, wrote a little memoir called God's Samurai. And that kind of change, which is largely unheralded in our history, I was shocked to hear about it, I think is very important for people to remember.
Well, there was another factor involved in that, as you were telling the story, and it was a luck of a turn of events in just a couple of minutes that the admiral on leading these aircraft carriers did not get his planes in the sky by just a moment or two, just literally a couple minutes. What happened there?
Well, they were in the process of changing the armaments, and it was considered to be a very fatal mistake. They had attacked Midway Island. There was an airstrip there. And they had bombed it, damaged it, but they hadn't completely destroyed it. So, being overconfident, the Japanese were suffering what later Japanese historians called victory disease. They were just so used to winning, they didn't think they had anything to worry about with the Americans. So, he rearmed the planes on his deck. Originally, they were going to go out and look for the American fleet. They knew there was an American fleet nearby. But then he thought, you know what? Let's go after the island first. The Americans will never find us. And in any event, it's a much inferior force. So he rechanged the armaments on the planes from armaments that would be used to hit aircraft carriers to other armaments would be used to strafe these little specks of land that are in the middle of the ocean. And while they were doing that is the precise moment that the planes sent out, well, largely by Admiral Ray Spruance. And this is another thing that is like one of those weird sorts of coincidences. He was one of the most effective naval commanders in history. And he only came to the battle late because Admiral Halsey, who probably would not have had the same patience and insight, Admiral Halsey had a skin rash that was devastating, and he was ordered to miss the battle in sick bay and replaced by Spruance. So everything fell into place. And it fell into place in a way that even Chester Nimitz, who was there, acknowledged. Despite the fact that he was not a religious believer, generally, that this was providential, that there was God in this, there was something that dictated that America had to win.
Let me just remind people I'm talking to Michael Medved, the famous New York Times bestselling author and radio host. His new book is God's Hand on America: Divine Providence in the Modern Era. Now, let me tell you, I like to go to Alaska. I go up there as often as possible. And I read in your book that there is another sign that we either had very good luck or Providence was at work, that Alaska is a United States state. What happened there?
Well, this is the story that really starts the book because my previous book about the rise of America, about the rise of the Republic and the miracles of the colonial period and the American Revolution is called The American Miracle. And that book ends with Lincoln's assassination on the night of April 14th, 1865. This book begins in 1865. And on April 5th, 9 days before Lincoln is killed, the Secretary of State, William Henry Seward, is out on a carriage ride. And he's out on a nice April afternoon. The war is just about won. There were only 4 days to go before Appomattox and Lee's surrender. So he's celebrating by going on an outing with his son and daughter. And there was a terrible carriage accident where the horses were spooked by something. They ran out of control. Seward tried to grab the reins. He fell out of the carriage. He fell on his face. He broke his arm. He broke both his upper and lower jaw, nearly drowned in his own blood, and was carried unconscious back to his home where he was expected to die. When the doctors were able to keep him alive and stabilize him, they devised this brace for his jaw so that it might heal and he could be able to speak and eat again. And it was made out of metal plates for both the upper and the lower jaw that would fit onto his neck. And it was wrapped around his head in canvas, sort of like a mummy. And he was wearing that. And literally, it was 9 days after the accident. He was finally that morning able to eat some of his first food. He took it in by a straw. And it looked like he was going to survive. That night, a stranger comes to his door, 10 p.m. on Friday night, April 14th. It's Good Friday. The stranger comes to the door, bangs on the door, and demands to be let in to bring medicine to Secretary Seward. Seward's son, who was also Assistant Secretary of State, says, "No, my father's resting." He is pistol whipped, banged over the head. And actually sent into a coma for over a month. And the intruder, whose name was Lewis Powell, goes upstairs. He's part of the John Wilkes Booth assassination conspiracy. At the same moment he is upstairs in Seward's bedroom, Lincoln is being shot in the head. So Powell takes a knife and brings it down repeatedly on Seward's throat, repeatedly. And it strikes the metal brace on his jaw. In other words, the accident that nearly killed him actually saved his life. Now, had that life not been saved, no Alaska. And historians agree on that. It was Seward acting while a president was preoccupied, Andrew Johnson, with an impeachment crisis. It was William Henry Seward who negotiated this incredible deal with Russia to take possession of Alaska. And John, here's the amazing thing that I didn't know before. In 2017, Russia observed the 150th anniversary of selling Alaska, Russian America, to the United States. And Putin honored it as a day of mourning because claimed that had that not happened, Russia would have won the Cold War. Because they would have been able to have missiles in Juneau, not just in Cuba. In any event, it is an amazing thought when you think how important that was. But here's something else that I found amazing, and I don't know that anybody else has written about this before, but I found it a major discovery. While Seward was negotiating with the Russians, he was also taking action, which he did in about 10 minutes, to take possession of an unclaimed three islands in the middle of the Pacific under the Guano Islands Act because they were considered to be a good source for bird fertilizer. I mean, bird poop. Those islands were the Midway Atoll. In other words, if Seward doesn't live, not only do we not have Alaska, but we don't have these little specks of land in the middle of the ocean that turn the entire tide and make American victory possible in World War II.
There's much of amazing stories in this book. Michael's just told two of them, but there's one I wanted to get to and make sure that we have your fulsome explanation of this one. And that is how the nation dodged a bullet, so to speak, when FDR took on Harry Truman as his vice president instead of letting Henry Wallace continue as FDR's vice president. Why was that so important?
Well, it was so important because of what we learned about Henry Wallace after he left the vice presidency. After he left the vice presidency, Henry Wallace was far more open about very longstanding affiliations with the American Communist Party. And he was, as vice president, he had visited Soviet Russia. He had, and now Russia was our ally during World War II. But in 1944, it was assumed that Wallace would be chosen by Roosevelt to run once again for Roosevelt's fourth term. He had been elected in 1940. In 1944, they did a Gallup poll, and overwhelmingly, the Democrats assumed Wallace would be the vice presidential candidate. There were a handful of people led by a fascinating guy from St. Louis named Bob Hannigan. And it turns out that most of these individuals were pretty serious Catholics. And Henry Wallace was, earlier he had been part of a very, very strange Russian guru cult. He really had. And they organized what they called the Conspiracy of the Pure of Heart to try to persuade President Roosevelt to take someone else as vice president. Because otherwise we would have a friend of Stalin and someone who was very positive on the bloody Soviet dictator as president of the United States. The problem was Roosevelt was sick. I write in the book, my dad, who was in the Navy in World War II, recalled for me that the worst day of his life at the time, he was 19 years old, was when FDR died. He said, we didn't know he was sick. We didn't even know he was mortal. He had been president for 12 years, and all of a sudden he dies. That would have made Wallace president of the United States. Instead, this conspiracy worked out remarkably well, choosing Harry Truman, who wasn't that well known, who had virtually no public support, and they basically forced Roosevelt's hand. There was also an amazing moment at the convention where literally they came within about 30 seconds of having a vote to nominate Wallace, which could have been by acclamation. And they gaveled the convention to stop, and then the next day history turned on a different axis, and Truman, of course, became someone who was considered either a great or a near great president. In those president rating files, Truman gets the rating usually of number 6 or number 7, greatest president ever. Henry Wallace, by the way, later acknowledged that this had to happen. He wrote a fascinating piece, which I quote extensively in God's Hand on America. He wrote a piece called Where I Was Wrong, about how wrong he had been about Russia and Stalin, and then expressed privately on several occasions that it needed to happen, that Truman replaced him on the ticket.
You know, what's so funny about Henry Wallace, because once again, until I read your book, I didn't know anything about him, didn't really care to know anything about him. But here's a very rich man from Iowa who made a lot of money developing hybrid seeds, I believe. Am I right about that?
Yes, exactly right.
So why was he so, you know, enamored of this Soviet communist system?
Well, of course, he claims he didn't know about the mass killings and the show trials. He had reason to know. He was Secretary of Agriculture, and then he was Vice President of the United States. Look, there were a lot of Americans. They just found another spy who had been there at Los Alamos working in the Manhattan Project. And people forget, you know, they think about the McCarthy era. And the McCarthy era, oh, it was all a witch hunt. It was all phony. Well, unfortunately, there were people very high in our government who identified with Stalin and with Soviet communism. And Wallace, after he was dumped as vice president, he became Secretary of Commerce, and then he resigned under Truman, and he then ran for president himself, challenging Truman as a progressive candidate Party candidate, and everyone acknowledged that that was a front for the American Communist Party. So this was a matter of true belief for him. He later apologized to the people in this piece he wrote, Where I Was Wrong, about having been blind to the enormous and incomparable evil of Bolshevism, communism.
You know, there is another story here that I wanted you to tell. One of America's favorite presidents is Teddy Roosevelt, who took a bullet to the chest. Why is it that he survived that assassination attempt?
He asked himself the same kind of question again and again. And the chapter in my book about Theodore Roosevelt, he, by the way, always hated it when people called him Teddy. And he was very insistent on Theodore. So even though we're all used to calling him Teddy Roosevelt, in respect to one of my favorite presidents, I'll call him Theodore. He was campaigning for president as a progressive. He had come back. He left the presidency after two terms, turned it over to his chosen successor, Secretary of War William Howard Taft, and then split with Taft over a range of issues, came back, challenged Taft in the primaries. Primaries had just been invented. And Roosevelt prevailed in most of the primaries, but there were enough delegates who were chosen the old way that he lost the Republican nomination to the convention. He ran as a third-party progressive candidate. He ended up finishing second, the only third-party candidate really ever in American history to finish second. No one has won in the presidency. And at the very end of his campaign, he was speaking, scheduled a big speech in Milwaukee. He went to dinner. He came out of the dinner. He was waving to people as he was getting into his car. And a nut named Schrank, who had been having dreams about it, writing poetry about it, shot him in the chest. And he collapsed and he started bleeding profusely. And then he did something that only Theodore Roosevelt would do. He said, I'm going to give my speech. They said, no, the doctors who were around him, there's a doctor traveling with him because he was having problems with his throat, said, no, you have to go to the hospital. He says, no, it takes more than one bullet to kill a bull moose. And he proceeded to the auditorium, spoke to 10,000 people. You know what's amazing, John? He spoke for nearly an hour. But the fact that he had such a long prepared text that he used saved his life, because he had taken this 50-page speech, he had folded it up twice, put it in his coat pocket together with his glasses case. That was what slowed the bullet enough so that it didn't hit him directly in the heart and kill him. He believed that the reason he ended up being spared was because he played the key role 100 years ago in getting America prepared for World War I, which, of course, World War I started 2 years after, almost exactly 2 years after he was shot. And from day one, he had recognized Roosevelt that America would inevitably become involved. And at the time, we had an army the size of Portugal. We had the 16th largest army in the world. We had completely demilitarized after the Spanish-American War, where he was such a war hero. And he believed, and I recount a conversation that he had shortly before he died in 1919, he believed that God had spared him precisely for that purpose.
You know, I can't let you go without telling the Franklin Roosevelt assassination story. Franklin Roosevelt, of course, a lot of people didn't know, or it was some efforts was made to cover up the fact that he was often in a wheelchair owing to polio. But as you tell this story, he kind of had a car. This was in Miami. He kind of had a car that this chair could be up high where he could either see or speak from. Have I got that right?
You do. In other words, what they did was they would put FDR, lift him up. It's a convertible. And they would lift him up in the back seat so he would be seated in the back of the convertible. Now, he has been elected president of the United States. It's February of 1933. The United States is at the complete nadir of the Depression. One third of Americans are unemployed. One third. The country is devastated. They are waiting for the new president to take power. He, to gather his strength, goes for 9 days sailing in the Caribbean with friends from Harvard. And on the way back, he stops in Miami and he's speaking to 25,000 people who have assembled in Bayfront Park in Miami. And while he is speaking on the back of the car, just as he has been lowered into the seat, five shots ring out. A would-be assassin named Giuseppe Zangara, a bricklayer from New Jersey, an anarchist, shoots five bullets at FDR, president-elect, from a distance, John, of 10 yards. It's that close. 10 yards. And one of the people standing right next to Roosevelt, Anton Cermak, who's mayor of Chicago, died. And there were four others who were injured. Roosevelt is uninjured. Now, here's the amazing part. 14 months earlier, there is a has-been British politician who's doing a speaking tour in New York. And his name is Churchill. And he is crossing Fifth Avenue looking for some. He's actually going to a party at Bernard Baruch's house because they were serving booze, and this is Prohibition, and Churchill liked his liquid refreshment. And Winston Churchill, in his wilderness years, is crossing Fifth Avenue when he's hit by a car going 35 miles an hour. And doctors stipulate it was a miracle that he lived. The car's wheels stopped inches from crushing his skull. And he wrote about it. He said, I do not understand why my head wasn't squashed like an eggshell. And both those two people were preserved. And this is in 1931, 32, 33, 14 months separating Christmas when Churchill's accident occurred. And the near assassination of FDR, it haunted both men. Churchill said when he became prime minister, and he wrote about it, he said, "I felt as if I were walking with destiny." Well, he was walking with destiny, and after that, he knew to look both ways before he crossed the street.
Yeah, the cars come from the other side in New York. So, if a person were to make the argument, what a lucky country, what would be your argument for maybe there's more to it?
Yeah, because if you're a lucky gambler and you keep winning time after time after time after time, then you begin to think, okay, either somebody's cheating or there's something strange going on here, like a little finger of fate is tipping the scales. And that's the case with the United States. That's why this is so important, John. I mean, we've just gone through the Thanksgiving holiday season, and I hated all this stuff about people wanting to treat it as a day of mourning and a gathering of grief, as if America should apologize for the fact that we have been a great blessing to all of humanity. Lincoln, as with most things, said it best. He described himself as an instrument, and he did that many, many times, an instrument of God's will. And that's what it is as America. It's not that we are a better country than anybody else. It's just that we have been chosen to implement God's will. Dr. Martin Luther King, who is the subject of one of my last chapters in the book, Dr. King said the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. If you're God, what better country to use than the United States of America? And I believe that God has used America to uplift the whole world. And again, when you look at our leaders, the people who have actually been responsible for this country, they have understood that. And it's why the knowledge of this history is so important. Because it's not just a lucky country. It's a country chosen for a purpose. And I do have one chapter in my book called The Abrahamic Advantage, which echoes the feelings of a lot of the founders that one of the purposes that people as early as John Adams had believed for the United States of America was to help protect and shield the children of Abraham, the Jewish people, and to fulfill prophecy by allowing the return of Jewish people to the Holy Land. And what's amazing about that is how that animated Americans long before the Zionist movement was ever organized, and animated Harry Truman in the fateful decision to recognize Israel just minutes after its declaration of independence.
It's a great book, Michael, and you know, congratulations. It's called God's Hand on America, Divine Providence in the Modern Era. Michael Medved, the best-selling author and famous radio host, is the author. It's been great talking to you, Michael. Thanks very much for your time.
John, always a pleasure to speak with you, and thanks for your contributions to this greatest nation on God's green earth.
Well, I'll thank you for the compliment, but I won't make too much of it. Michael Medved, thank you again.
Thank you.
So please go check out Michael Medved's book, God's Hand on America, Divine Providence in the Modern Era, on Amazon and other places where you can get books, including brick-and-mortar stores and online.